Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Steve Long, who is the director of the East Hampton Historical Society. Is that the correct name?
You got it. Thank you.
Hold it on the first try. I know of it as building right on Main Street, along with so many other important public buildings, as well as that comprise the colonial aspect of East Hampton. The library is there, the Ladies Village Improvement Society is there, and Home Sweet Home across the street, and the windmills and the ponds, and it's quite something. When was the Historical Society founded?
Well, we were founded in 1921 here at Clinton Academy, but we are, in some respects, we're like a mini version of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, in addition to Clinton Academy, which was built as a school in 1784. We have Mulford Farm. You referenced Home Sweet Home, where Mulford Farm is located right next door to Home Sweet Home, and it was built initially in 1680, and during the American Revolution was the home of one of East Hampton's leading patriots. And then we have the Domini Shops Museum that is on North Main Street, where the three generations of famed woodworkers made everything from coffins to cradles. We have the Marine Museum in Amagansett, and then we also manage the townhouse, which was East Hampton's first purpose-built government affairs building, right next door to Clinton.
Tell me about Home Sweet Home.
Home Sweet Home has got such an interesting story. It was reputed to be the home of John Howard Payne, who wrote the song Home Sweet Home, which was such a big hit in the 19th century, a song that everybody was listening to. And he never lived there in Home Sweet Home. When Hugh King, our village and town historian, and Bob Hefner were working on the historic structure report, really delving into the research about the house, it turned out that probably if John Howard Payne was never, you know, a longtime resident of East Hampton, and for the time he was here, he actually probably lived in the old Osborne Law Office building that's at 135 Main Street, never at Home Sweet Home. But the story got started in the 19th century, early 20th century, that it was the home of John Howard Payne. And it just caught fire to the point that Gustav and Hannah Buch purchased the house and really made it a shrine to John Howard Payne. They collected all kinds of objects that you can see when you go inside the museum today. And it's such a cool story about sort of the how a museum is made almost, and that kind of history of East Hampton. And when Gustav Buch passed away in 1927, his wife offered it for sale to the village for $60,000, which was pretty much the entire annual budget of East Hampton Village at the time, in an astronomical sum of money. And the village purchased it. It had the Panago Mill located right behind, which the Buchs had moved to that location. And it has been a museum ever since the late 1920s.
Honestly, I had no idea all of these different museums were all connected up under one roof, so to speak.
There was a historian named Tim Breen back in the 1980s, who did some research about Mulford Farm and about East Hampton, and wrote a book called East Hampton Histories, Imagining the Past, East Hampton Histories. And what I find so interesting about it is he writes, and it's not very favorable what he says, but he says in East Hampton, they take their history very seriously. And I think in some sense, that's really a point of pride that we as a community have always been very interested in preserving not just the colonial past, but even the 19th and 20th and now the 21st century past.
How did you get involved with this? And growing up, were you always interested in history?
I've always had an interest in the past. Loved going to history museums even as a little kid. I worked for a long time as vice president of collections and education at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City. I was recruited to be the director of the Children's Museum in Bridgehampton. Thought I'd spend a couple of years there, maybe move elsewhere. But I met my wife, whose family lived in Montauk, and she did not want to live anywhere but the town of East Hampton. So after about a dozen or so years at the Children's Museum, I moved over here to the East Hampton Historical Society, which is about a mile away from where I live, so a much easier commute, and really back to my original passion.
What strikes in your mind? There's so much history. I mean, we have 20 minutes. What comes to the fore in your mind as maybe the most interesting piece of history in East Hampton?
Dan, we only have 20 minutes. That's a big question. It's Black History Month. And one of the things that I find so fascinating is the history of slavery here in East Hampton. David Rattray, Donna Marie Barnes developed the Plain Sight Project. And I think that is so interesting in how most of us never really learned about slavery in the North. Slavery was always a Southern thing. And we had the Civil War that ended slavery in the United States. But when you really research it, you discover that East Hampton had, when it was initially founded, you know, by white settlers in the late 17th and early 18th century, almost 20% of the population was African American here in East Hampton. And Mulford Farm, there were 8 enslaved individuals in 1776, enumerated as part of the Suffolk County Census. And it's so interesting. I mean, it's this American paradox to me that, like, what the historian Edmund Morgan wrote about 50 years ago, that you have these vocal supporters of American liberty and independence, George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, and in their communities, they're among the largest slaveholders. And when you're walking through Mulford Farm, in some respects, you're really walking in the footsteps not only of East Hampton's leading patriot, but also the people that he enslaved. And it's such a contradiction. And to kind of explore that contradiction, to me, is one of the things that makes history so fascinating.
Are there important original papers or objects in the museum that you come to mind that people might enjoy seeing?
Well, the Historical Society, we really focus on three-dimensional objects. Our sister organization at the Long Island Collection of the East Hampton Library, we really encourage people to donate their archives, their papers, their photographs, so that we have the objects. And one of the things that I love about our collection is that it covers the whole gamut. Anything you can imagine, including a kitchen sink, we have in the collection of the East Hampton Historical Society. It's nearly 20,000 artifacts. We really have one of the premier collections of Dominie furniture. As I mentioned, the Dominies were woodworkers really from the 1760s up till about the 1850s. And they were renowned for their clocks, especially all kinds of timepieces. And they made, it's estimated, about 90 of these clocks. A few of them are at the Winterthur Collection down at really America's premier decorative arts museum, which is down, started by the DuPont family in Winterthur, Delaware. They have a few. We have in East Hampton about 15 of them. And this summer, we're going to be exhibiting a lot of those so that we can have a whole exhibit about time, the way that not only we think about time and sort of what is history, it's change over time, but also what I think is so fascinating about the Dominies, Nathaniel IV. There were many generations of Nathaniels. It's the thing in East Hampton. Every family, they always use the same name over and over and over again. But Nathaniel IV, when he turned 50, a ripe old age back in end of the 18th century, he starts putting time aphorisms on his clocks. So we're going to be exhibiting a lot of those clocks that have those aphorisms. I mean, like time is, it was, time flies, those kinds of things. So people will be able to see that and really start to think about sort of the time in their own lives.
The Domini building on North Main Street, which is their original location and also was their workshop, has what I consider a very modest sign. You wouldn't notice it when you go by, and I wondered if that were deliberate or not. If it was a bigger sign, maybe people wouldn't notice it. It doesn't appear to be open to the public, even though it should be.
It's open through guided tours, which is the most successful way. We're in the midst of changing an exhibition that will be opening late spring. As I said, really focus on the clocks. The sign is from the Pomeroy Foundation, which I think it really indicates that this is not just an important landmark in our East Hampton community, but it's recognized by New York State. And in fact, it could be recognized on, say, the Federal Register as an important location, even though a lot of the house is a reconstruction. The original house was dismantled in the 1940s, which is another fascinating story about, how it had the possibility of being preserved. It wasn't. It was dismantled, but then it was reconstructed on, as you mentioned, its original location, where it was for centuries before the 1940s.
Did they save any of the beams from the original?
There was a man named Dudley Roberts who had foresight to preserve the two workshops, the clock shop and the carpentry shop. And he moved them to his property on Further Lane in about 1946, and they were there for decades. He kind of put them together as sort of a like a guest house, pool house kind of arrangement. And then he was no longer owning that property, but the new owners offered them to the village of East Hampton, which serendipitously owned the property where the house and the workshops were originally located. So there was the parking lot that's there by the emergency services building. That was essentially, they rolled back a little bit of the parking lot and, in fact, revealed some of the original footings where the house was placed when it was originally constructed in the 18th century and existed, as I said, up until the 1940s. So, yes, a lot of the historic fabric in that museum today is original. It just happened to be on Further Lane for several decades till it was moved back to where it had been originally constructed.
Well, we know one of the big historical events in East Hampton was the landing during World War II of four Nazi saboteurs. And I wondered if any three-dimensional objects are in the collection from that.
We actually have a piece of the dynamite box when they were discovered. And with our another sister site, the Life-Saving Station Museum does a whole program about the landing of the Nazi saboteurs. And I mean, that could have been a much more horrific situation than it turned out to be. It was, in many respects, the United States was very lucky, really no damage to speak of that those saboteurs could potentially have carried out, but were thwarted for a number of reasons.
Well, that's a very interesting piece of history. Another one that I've always wondered about was right at the corner where Main Street turns onto Woods Lane. Was Nimmo, what's her name?
Yep. Well, so right by is another one of the Historical Society's properties, the Thomas and Mary Nimmo Moran Home and Studio. And that was restored by the Thomas Moran Trust. And just fairly recently, we have completed the merger, and the Thomas Moran Trust transferred that property to the East Hampton Historical Society. And in many respects, Thomas and Mary, who were acclaimed artists, I mean, Thomas Moran's painting of the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone that he did in the early 1870s was purchased by Congress for $10,000, the U.S. Congress. And it really had a major impact in that it influenced the federal government to establish the National Park Service and make Yellowstone Park the first official U.S. national park. And a lot of that had to do with the impact that this painting had on the American public. In 1884, Thomas and Mary Nemo Moran finished the construction of that house and moved in and essentially summered there. Thomas Moran summered there every year until 1922. And what was so important about him is that he influenced other artists. He really was, in many respects, an artistic pioneer in establishing East Hampton as an art colony. He had all kinds of people that he knew and friends who would come out and visit, and then they wound up purchasing houses here as well. And it, I think, directly led to, you know, what we think of East Hampton today as being still a very kind of community steeped in the arts. And that all goes back to Thomas and Mary Nemo Moran getting that foothold into this community.
I recall from reading the history of it and seeing photographs of a Venetian gondola.
Oh, the gondola. Yes. So when Thomas passed away, Nemo Moran had died prior to him, his daughter inherited all of the family's papers and a lot of their objects. And then when she died in 1949, all of that collection went to the East Hampton Library. And there's sketches and there's photo books and all kinds of things that the East Hampton Library, the Long Island collection that I referenced earlier, has in its collection. One of the objects that wound up in the collection of the library was a 36-foot long gondola. And that doesn't fit very easily into the stacks. And so the library was trying to figure out, what are we going to do with this gondola? Mary and Thomas had acquired it after going to Venice in 1890. They had taken a trip there together. And what does one do in Venice? One takes a gondola ride. And if you're the Morans, what do you do after you take your gondola ride? You purchase a gondola. And there were stories actually of George Fowler, who was Montaukett and was a gardener for the Morans. They hired him in addition to doing their gardening work to be their gondolier on Hook Pond. And so they had this gondola that was acquired by the library. What to do? The library said, well, East Hampton Historical Society, won't you take it? You have some space along with the Ladies Village Improvement Society. We were sharing Mulford Farm in the late 40s, early 50s. We had just acquired that property. But at the time, the Historical Society's collection was so focused on colonial artifacts. What are we doing with this Venetian gondola? So we gave it back to the library. And then the library cast about, who in America will take our gondola? And the Maritime Museum in Newport News, Virginia, raised its hand and said, we would love your gondola. So it was packed up onto a railroad car at the East Hampton train station, transferred to New York, and it traveled down to Newport News, where it is still on display in the Maritime Museum, even to this day.
That makes a bit of sense because that whole area was devoted largely to the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen early submarines in different places like that.
The first U.S. Confederate submarines sort of did battle in that area as well. So it's got a long maritime tradition, different, but it's a similar tradition to what we have here in Amagansett with the Marine Museum on Bluff Road.
Tell me what kinds of presentations are you going to be doing this summer?
So we have been working with the East Hampton Library on the Tom Toomey series. So each month we're going to be having a different lecture. We're going to be having a couple that's focused specifically on the American Revolution. We're also focused on the restoration of the Mulford Farmhouse. When the Historical Society, remember I mentioned we acquired it in the late 40s, actually 1948, it was gifted to the Historical Society. And there has not been a comprehensive restoration of that interior since it was acquired. We've done some restoration here or there, but really nothing in the last 25 years. And you know, we have some peeling paint and cracked plaster that we need to address. And what we want to do is restore it back to 1776 so that when visitors enter, they will see it as it likely looked when it was the home of Colonel David Mulford and his family of six children and his wife. And I'm excited about telling this Revolutionary War story because East Hampton and Long Island in general has been marginalized when it comes to the American Revolution. The Patriots lost the Battle of Long Island, and unlike Concord and Lexington and so many other, Trenton and Valley Forge, where the Minutemen were celebrated, our Minutemen here in East Hampton were forgotten. And the town of East Hampton, Long Island, was occupied from 1776 until 1783 by British soldiers. And because of that, I think we have not celebrated our involvement in the American Revolution the way we should have been. It's been sort of, even back during the Bicentennial, there was no real exhibitions or stories about what happened here in East Hampton. There was an exhibit of quilts and we had a 4th of July parade. But all of us in the town of East Hampton that work in the history field, we really want to celebrate the patriot fervor that inspired our community. Even though we were occupied here, we had a lot of people leave as refugees, we're as important to the American Revolutionary story as Saratoga and Yorktown and anywhere else in the 13 colonies.
And we also had the first English settler in Lyon Gardner in 1639.
Indeed, and he is buried in South End Burying Ground. He was the first European settler, but of course, there was settlement and human history long, long before Lyon Gardner showed up and really teaching that Montaukett history and partnering with groups who can celebrate the indigenous life and culture that was here long, long before any Europeans or transplants from Connecticut or Massachusetts.
I want to thank you for being on this podcast, and maybe we'll go around again with more stories.
Well, Dan, I'm so grateful for the opportunity, and it's an honor to be with you. So thank you.
Well, sure. Same. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.